I'm Brax McCoy, and this is the Brax McCoy Show. On this episode, I sit down with my good friend Joe Kent and talk about his run for Congress in Washington. We hit on some of the big cultural issues of our day. Talk about the potential currency inflation that I think a lot of us are worried might be coming, what we can do about it, and a lot about how much rhinos suck. So if you're into all that, sit through it. And if you want to support the show, which I hope you do, please get on whatever you're... Actually, just pause it right now. Jump on your app, wherever you're playing it through, whether it's iTunes or Stitcher or whatever, and leave us a rating and a review. I'm trying to get 30 on this first one because it will boost us in the algorithm, but it'd be great to get even more. So if you want to help, please do that. And you should want to help because you're a good person. So thank y'all. Enjoy Joe Kent. This is Brax McCoy. I'm here with Joe Kent. Joe, why are you running for Congress in Washington?
Man, I'm getting right into it. So, hey, I am running for Congress in Washington State to push back on pretty much everything the left is trying to do right now. So my district is the third congressional district, and we are crammed right in between failing Democrat-led cities that are trying to pretty much come in and take over our key terrain that connects their cities. So right now the left is, as you've probably mentioned before, they're moving in lockstep. I think on the cultural front, the media front, they have control of those institutions. They have control of the government now. We saw what they did with the cooperation of big tech and the media in the 2020 election. And I really feel like this moment that we're in right now is kind of a sink or swim moment for traditional American values and really for the fate of our republic. So I didn't want to, you know, sit back and watch all that happen. I didn't really know exactly how I wanted to get involved. And then my congresswoman, who I voted for, who in theory is a Republican, she was always kind of a weak Republican, went in and cast her vote to impeach President Trump before any of the facts of January 6th were released. And then she volunteered to be like the Democrat star witness during the sham impeachment trial. She claimed to have like third hand information or something like that. So that made it pretty clear to me that I was like, well, there's my sign. I never wanted to be a politician, but I couldn't think of a clearer sign to get me, you know, kind of off the bench and involved once again.
Awesome. We'd be lucky to have you. That brings me up that Washington Post article. You remember that you, of course, they had to put out that retraction. Maybe it was 2 weeks ago or something. Yep. Was that what she was referring to when she volunteered to be a witness?
Yeah, I mean, she claimed that she overheard a conversation between Kevin McCarthy and President Trump. And then she hasn't really answered any direct questions about it. She claimed that she could hear what Trump was saying, but McCarthy said that didn't happen. So it gets pretty foggy on what really went on. But I mean, you can tell, you know, the incentive system set up by the media, especially in DC, you know, if you're a Republican that's willing to say something against President Trump, you are one, cleansed of all your sins of being a Republican temporarily, and then you're also given a greater platform to kind of, you know, propel you into your next chapter, whatever that kind of is. So she seemed very opportunistic to me. That was kind of my take.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on, and it makes me a thing that I wonder about all the time when I'm out working, trying to, I kind of think about this stuff while I'm working. People have gotten after me on Twitter before, and it's always, you know, unfortunately, it's like some woke person, a lot of times from the veteran community, and they'll say, you know, well, all you ever do is bag on the left. And I'm like, man, I don't know, you must not be following me, because I feel like all I do is bag on Republicans on there. I hardly ever talk about the left, because I look at it as, I know what the left are. I know what they're doing. I hate that. Exactly. But you guys are supposed to be on my team, and you never are, you know, or very few of you are.
Yeah, I mean, with friends like these, I guess, is the statement. Yeah, so that's another reason why, even though I never really intended on joining, you know, the political fray in this capacity, it just felt right, because, you know, the catalyst was obviously the way that she voted, but she's just been a terrible Republican for a while now. I mean, she didn't support the border wall, voted with the Democrats to pull away funding from President Trump's border wall. But then just a week ago, she was trying to raise funds on Say No to Joe Biden's you know, open borders. And then a week later, she votes for the amnesty bill. So she's just obviously running this con. And it's like, okay, with Republicans like this, man, we just got to get rid of them. Otherwise, we're not going to have a, you know, a party, or we're not going to have an actual opposition party for one. And then we're just not going to stand a chance. So I agree with you. I'm all about turning our ire on the Republican establishment, because the left's going to do what the left's going to do. We all know that.
Totally. So speaking of that, have you seen that the Biden administration is now proposing shipping illegal immigrants from the southern border to the Canadian border?
I did, man. I saw that. Yeah. I mean, it's breathtaking that the pace the Biden administration is moving on. So like, I guess now they figured that since they lost so much ground in the Rio Grande Valley, and they just can't absorb that many illegal immigrants, they're just going to start shipping them in to the north and just kind of surround the country, I guess, is the plan. Because I guess if you look at it that way, you can get even more illegal immigrants in, which is good for all the corporations that haven't been affected by COVID lockdowns, who are just going to hire illegals as opposed to paying Americans. And then, you know, it's also good for the amnesty bills and the pathways to citizenship that they're proposing to totally take over, you know, the Electoral College.
Yeah. And let me ask you this. I don't know if you guys see this in Washington or not, but there's a lot of big farms that will sort of quietly support this kind of stuff. And they're always, you know, large corporate farms. And it's because they, you know, they know that they're going to have people to exploit. Whereas the small family ranch, like our little farm, you know, it affects us and doesn't, you know, it helps them and hurts us essentially. And we're the voting block. And so we make up the voting block, but we're the small donor, you know, we're sort of the meaningless person to whichever Republican candidate is. And here in Idaho, we have, you know, our Republican representatives are just absolute garbage, so far as I'm concerned. They're just neocon, you know, Democrats of the 90s at very best. And so I wonder, like in Washington, is this what you're seeing too? Is the small guy hates it, the big guy loves it?
Yeah, completely. I mean, all of our agricultural industry and then the timber industry, which has been gutted by federal regulation, but all these I'd say staples of our economy, the big corporate donors there, a lot of them, they get really quiet on the immigration issue. And then they will support, usually with the coordination of their labor unions too, which is weird, you know, Democrats heavily. So you got to look at who stands to gain. And then they won't sound off when, you know, Biden's proposing $15 minimum wages, because they know they're never going to have to pay it, because they're going to, for the most part, hire two or three illegals and then, you know, be able to get them out of town as seasonal workers and not ever have to pay W-2 employees $15 an hour. They know that that's all just a talking point. So, I mean, I think everything that the left is trying to do right now really targets the working and middle class and even the upper middle class. So anybody who's just a hardworking American right now, the transfer of wealth that we're seeing that benefits the technocrats and the bureaucrats is really being driven hard by the left right now. And they're not even being shy about it, between immigration, HR1. The tax raises that Biden said were only going to target corporations. But then when they reveal the plan, it's like, well, by corporations, I meant, you know, if you and your wife make $400,000 a year, like they're just not even hiding it anymore.
Absolutely. So I have another question. I was talking to a mutual friend of ours, and you know this guy in real life, and we were discussing everything that's going on with the farm bill and just sort of the future of the economic future of America, rather. And all of these sort of things came up, but I pointed out that it almost feels as if, and I don't want to be the exaggeratory guy that's calling everything in the world communism, but it almost feels as if this, you know, you use the word technocrat, and it is technocrat, but this technocrat elite is bringing in the principles of some of the ideas of communism without the actual principles. Like in the ag industry, well, we saw Governor, I think it was Cuomo, that said, well, anybody can, you know, plant a seed and be a farmer or whatever. And that's exactly what, you know, led the Soviets to starve, was that sort of mindset, you know. Yeah. And we're doing that again now. And it's like, well, who cares if everything is aggregated into these giant corporate farms? I mean, at least we're all eating, right? But it doesn't, like, that kind of system doesn't last. I mean, think of the last the 2008 economic crisis, some firms, you know, financial firms that have been in business for like 150 years went under. Like, if you don't think that can happen to corporate farms, especially if they've, you know, bit off too large of a chunk of the industry, then I think you're out of your mind. And sure, the small guy might be able to gobble some of that up and start to rebuild, but it would be very slow, and it would hurt for a while. You know, like, the idea of America, at least I thought, was decentralization as much as possible. Exactly. Here we are centralizing everything, but we're just doing it under this technocrat elite rather than, you know, sort of nationalizing it for the people or whatever, which was another form of technocracy, really, if we're being honest with ourselves.
I think it's just breathtaking, the pace that they're moving, and they are using, like you said, the general ideas or the catchphrases of socialism and communism, because somehow, I think because the left infiltrated the cultures and the education system a long time ago, that resonates with a younger generation who don't fully understand it, probably going back to education because they weren't really, you know, taught the horrors of communism. But really, it's all being done to give not power to the people, it's being done to give, you know, power to a handful of, you know, global corporations, some technocrats, and then of course the bureaucratic class that exists within the Beltway. And I mean, if we think guys like Cuomo can run the farming industry because it's as simple as sticking seeds in the ground, as he says, then we're going to starve to death. I mean, we saw, like, when we let the government play fast and loose with, like, the housing market and, you know, all that, and when it exploded in 2008, like, that was pretty bad. But can you imagine that with, like, big farms and big agriculture? That wouldn't just be people losing their bank accounts. That'd be people not getting food for weeks on end. So, I mean, to me, just the absolute scale of what the left is trying to do right now is just, it's pretty scary. And it's pretty scary they were able to do it and do it so fast, and all the different buttons. I think 2020 dropped the veil on how many different buttons the left could push at once. I mean, We saw kicking Trump off Twitter and everything that followed. It's just been very eye-opening.
Yeah, I agree. And what do you think the solution to the actual getting kicked off Twitter thing is? I mean, I've heard people suggest things like a decentralized social media platform that would, like, link up to all of your accounts or whatever, and people would follow you on that. So if you got banned from, say, Twitter or Facebook, they would just automatically be linked to your other stuff, so it wouldn't hurt you as much. It sounds like a really cool idea. But the problem is, well, what if they just, you know, do what they did to Parler and, you know, go after the source? So, like, how do we fight this, do you think?
Man, I really think we have to get people in government, especially in Congress and in the Senate, that are going to have formal hearings, as cliche as it is, and not just subpoena, you know, Dorsey and Zuckerberg and let them talk circles around them, but actually get into the weeds on how we limit corporations' ability to have such control over people's lives. Because the tech, you know, the tech industry right now, they're essentially they're the robber barons, or they're the Standard Oil of our day. Mm-hmm. And it's even more invasive than that, because, you know, when we were writing Section 230, or we were coming up with, you know, the various laws at the time that these corporations are hiding behind, I don't think anybody had the imagination to imagine how I guess ubiquitous is the way to put it, that the internet is for all of us. You know, even if you think of yourself as somewhat of a Luddite, I mean, like, your bank accounts are still ones and zeros at the end of the day. So pretty much anybody, if they, you know, draw the ire of a handful of tech people, they can pretty much be deleted from life. And so I think that's just too much power for these corporations to have. I think Section 230 reform is just the start. But it's got to be deeper than that. We've got to make sure that just a handful of people can't just be like, well, we're going to kick this entire app off the internet, and then we're going to completely and totally demonetize you. Because, I mean, we saw what they did with Trump. We saw what they did with Parler. I don't think it's too far of an exaggeration for them to be like, I don't like what Joe and Braxton are talking about. Let's delete their bank accounts and make it so their kids don't have health insurance anymore. Like, that's the same press of a button as, you know, kicking an app off a platform.
Well, absolutely. And There's precedent. I think a lot of Americans don't know this, but you know, they have done this to people. That they did it to Laura Loomer, that Enrique Tarrio from the Proud Boys, they did it to him. And I'm not like some Proud Boys fan, but I'm just pointing out that they have done this already to people.
Yep.
It's absolutely insane. In fact, this network, what Gail and Dave have done is they just went out and bought some servers and said, well, we're going to run our own thing. I mean, we're going to put it up everywhere else, but if they try to kick us off, it'll still be alive somewhere.
Yeah.
Which would be great, but it feels like a really good short-term solution, and I want it to work, but
exactly
in the long term and en masse, I mean, the average American's not going to, you know, go out and buy servers and set their own stuff up. So I think that your ideas are good, and you're right to call them robber barons, because if there's ever been a true monopoly in the history of America, I really think it's these. You know, they try to say Twitter and Facebook are competitors, but they're really not competitors. I mean, they're different. I understand that they're social media networks, but their platforms are so different that they're more like adjacent rather than direct competitors. Does that make sense? And then you've got Facebook owns WhatsApp and Instagram, and I'm freaking tech boomer, so I'm not going to pretend to understand the ones and zeros of it, but they own a huge portion of this. And when you're saying, when they throw their weight behind a news story, we saw it swing an election. I mean, it absolutely did.
Yeah. And now all the direct interference that like Zuckerberg was doing, you know, giving money to all those different organizations that were doing, you know, ballot drops and putting in ballot boxes, all that stuff is now just coming to light. Well, probably because they control the entire media apparatus. So, totally. Yeah, I think we have to break these guys up. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. And even if that's going to be ugly, and I don't know, there's no one good, you know, everyone says Section 230, like it's going to change something. Like, I think Section 230 would just be the start. I think this is some serious work that our elected officials have to do, and they have to, because if the government can't take these guys on, then basically nobody can. And that's pretty scary.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And so one of the things that I've talked about with this a lot, is balkanization. And I know that sounds terrible, especially for a patriotic minded guy, but, a friend of mine put it this way, and I thought it was smart. He said, rather than a divorce, what we need is like a legal separation, something much closer to the original Federalist intent of the Constitution, or the Articles of Confederacy, even better. But there are some counties in Washington and Oregon that have made real steps toward this recently, which I thought was pretty interesting. Have you been following those stories at all?
I have been. I have one of the counties that's made the news a little bit, Lewis County in Washington, that has Mossy Rock, where the law enforcement said they weren't going to enforce our governor's lockdown orders. Actually, one of our counties as well, Klickitat County, had a sheriff who took a similar stand. And then same thing, there's been some proposals here that are pretty anti-2A, and the sheriff said, like, we're not enforcing that. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And I think I think the issue is almost a rural versus urban divide that kind of transcends like states. Because I went to CPAC this year for the first time, and I talked to guys that are running for office in, you know, upstate New York, and then guys that are running in Florida, and it's almost the same themes. You know, the working class base is fired up because everything we just talked about, but then you also have all these. I would say the dichotomy is the blue states that are controlled by very activist governors like we have on the West Coast, or a guy like Cuomo. But then you got like at least half, if not more, of the state that's very red. And there's, you know, agriculture, you know, people making their living off the land that kind of just want to be left alone. So I do think we're going to start seeing it. But the problem is, it's not a clean Balkanization. When the Balkans happened, like it was obviously messy, because there was bleed over of like where the different populations were, but there were still more well-defined lines there. Whereas in America, it's not like, I mean, the Civil War, okay, great, Mason-Dixon line, we fight each other. Like, that made sense, sure. But right. Now it's like people in rural Washington have less in common with people that are a 45-minute drive away from them than they do with the guy that lives 3,000 miles away, but he lives in a red district in a blue state too. So it's going to be messy, and we're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that people know that their voices are heard in their government. Otherwise, we're going to get disenfranchised. And that, I mean, that I know I'm moving fast, but that ties into vote election integrity too, because I think there's a lot of people that feel disenfranchised right now. And I think that leads to a very scary place.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. If you look at the Civil War, for example, you can point to tariffs or slavery or any of these other, you know, those are kind of the two main things that people like to talk about what really caused it. But if you really think about it, it was disenfranchisement that really lit the powder keg. You know, Abraham Lincoln was elected without a single electoral vote from the South. So disenfranchisement goes to really ugly places really fast. And I'm afraid, like, if we don't get a hold of ourselves, we're going to be doing the same thing.
That's why the what we started talking about, the Rhino Republicans, who are just like, oh, we can't talk about 2020. Like, let's just go along with the mainstream media's narrative and we'll try and do better next time. And I think, like, man, that's garbage. Like, there's questions that need to be answered about 2020, whether people think it was stolen or whatnot. But there was obvious discrepancies that if we don't adjudicate, there's going to be a ton of people that are like, well, my vote doesn't matter. And then what's the next logical step after, well, my vote doesn't matter?
Correct.
People get violent, man. Like, it just, that just is what it is, you know? So yeah. I think it's something that that's another duty. I think the government is doing a really good job of shirking right now. Like, I really like that Clarence Thomas spoke out about it, but the rest of the courts have just been like, ooh, yeah, I'm going to find a technicality so I don't have to be the guy that addresses that. Like, they're cowards.
I totally agree. And their cowardice, ultimately might cost lives, which obviously I hope it doesn't, but it really might. And the entire party as a whole, like my governor here, Little, he just does everything he can to avoid being confrontational with anyone ever. And I can tell you, I talked to my neighbors. They hate the guy. Most of these guys, they're not like convinced that the election was somehow stolen or anything, but they want answers to, like, they feel like there were questions at the end of it. And, you know, like you say, they just shirked those questions and that responsibility the responsibility to answer them. And these guys are pretty upset about it. I mean, I drive up the valley and, you know, there's still Trump flags hanging on ranch gate arches and stuff. And I mean, these are like uber religious people that didn't even like Trump in 2016. You know, they ended up falling in love with him later on, but, you know, so there are real people that are pretty dang upset about everything that they're looking at, you know?
Yeah, it's the same out here. It's honestly, my county or my district's pretty diverse geographically, and people make their livings in different ways. But the consistent theme I keep hearing from people is, how do we know our votes counted? Like, was that the first rigged election for the rest of our lives that we're going to have to face? Or are we actually going to do something about this? And they're frustrated that no one is actually having these discussions, or there's few people that are having the discussion. So I really think it's something that we have to address. I mean, people, the events of January 6th were like pretty horrible. I think it was a small group of people that acted violently. There's a lot to go over there, but in general, like, I don't see how you can't act surprised when violence has been incentivized for like 6 or 7 months by one side. And then one day the other side's like, you know what? I'm going to do violence too. Like, we can't have this system where violence is incentivized. And then we also tell people that, like, the vote is whatever the TV said it was, and you can't ask any questions or we'll throw you off of social media. Like,
yeah.
And for all that to happen and there to be no violence, like, the for me, that math just doesn't work out.
Yeah. And then, you know, I'm not a condoner of any of that stuff, obviously, but the media, the corporate press has relentlessly called that whole event an insurrection. Yet there was not a single gun, so far as I know, found.
Right. So still waiting for them to find that weapons cachet, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's the worst insurrection ever. I mean, it's like, got your podium, government's mine now. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. The MAGA shaman got let in by the police, and they're like, don't trash the place. And he's like, cool, man, just some selfies.
Yeah. Right. It's just crazy. Meanwhile, as you allude to, you know, we watched cities burn all year. I mean, it's just incredible. But I've heard people like Cernovich say that the hypocrisy is the point, and I tend to agree. I really think it is.
Yes.
So it's cool that you're you know, you see, this is what, in my opinion, this is what we really need. I don't need, at this point, I actually don't even think where this person comes from even matters, because this war is a cultural war. And I think if you look at what I'm saying, is this is what we need in there in the Republicans. We need someone who's not a boomer, and, you know, who's not going to wilt under pressure. If you think of, look at what AOC did as a freshman congressperson. I mean, granted, she's kind of, you know, annoying, yep, and all of this stuff, but she moved the needle in a way that Sanders didn't in 40 years in office.
Yeah, exactly.
So I don't think it really matters where that person comes from. It just matters who that person is. And that's why I'm like behind you so much, because, you know, I thought someone like Crenshaw was going to be the guy, but, you know, I kind of overlooked how much he loves these forever wars that I hate. But I thought, well, you know, at least he knows how to use social media. Maybe he'll make a change. But now, you know, and I'm not trying to bag on the guy, but watching him, I'm like, dude, you are just becoming Rhino Republican, whether you realize it or not. I mean, so when this happens to people like that, and I'm not asking you to talk about anyone specifically, because obviously you're gonna have to work with these people and eat lunch with them and stuff. But do you think that they get there? And then, so I've done a little bit of work on the Hill, not a lot, not even as much as you, I'm sure, but do you think it's when they get there, they realize, do they come to a realization, or are they like straight up instructed that you will follow the party line, or you're going to be, you know, out on the street, you know, begging for donors?
Both, man. And it's a weird system we have set up too, especially Congress, because they run every 2 years, and we're 2 years out right now. Mine's weird because, you know, it's a primary challenge and all that, but they're basically in a constant cycle of asking people for money. I think at least with the Senate, I'm pro term limits. I think we should have them, but I think 2 years puts the Congress people in this position where they're constantly having to ask people for money. And so that gives the PACs and the donors like so much power over Congress. But I think overall it's for all the elected officials. I mean, you know, the deal, like in DC, you know, that you get there and there's a bunch of people, if you have a position of prestige or power, there's a bunch of the people that are waiting for you to fall so they can step into the void. So I think if you get there and you're a smart enough person, you can see pretty clearly that your job is to be on good terms with pretty much everybody. And that just creates that swampy environment where like the best interest of the American people aren't being pursued whatsoever. It's all about go along to get along and make sure you're getting paid, and make sure that you're making enough money and your friends are the right people. Cause if you don't, you know, and you take a wrong stand and you're the one that gets canceled, or you fall out of good grace with this pack or that pack, like, then you're done. That, I mean, that's overall why I think we need more guys and girls that necessarily don't want to go, but they know it's the right thing to do. And if they do go and they end up maybe not being able to make enough friends to make it a career, like, that's okay. That district like organically has a deep bench and they can push another good regular person forward to just keep like chipping away at it, you know, because on the conservative side, we're not going to get the media jumping in behind us like they did with AOC to give us the boost, you know?
Absolutely.
So I think it's going to be tough. Yeah. And I just think it's just such a power hungry environment there in DC, driven by money.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of a weirdo with my kids. I don't want them watching any of this communist trash. So they watch, you know, like a lot, like if they watch anything, it's old stuff like Davy Crockett from the 50s and stuff. And there's this one scene where Davy, in this one show, Davy Crockett show, where he, you know, he gets elected or whatever, and he's given this speech about how garbage this bill is. And if any of, he's talking about the people in the room, obviously, but he says, if any of us who were chosen and selected to be here by our people were really, really had their best interests at heart, this bill wouldn't even get past our desk, let alone show up for a vote and all this. And I thought, wow, man, that thing was made like, you know, 60 years ago or whatever. I don't know what year it was made, but it's made, you know, roughly a half century ago plus. And the problems were so evident at the time that like the average, because it's not just that the writer gets it, the writer has to understand that the person watching will get it too, you know what I mean? So the average person felt this way, you know, half a century ago, and so we're, in many ways, we might just be hitting sort of the culmination of that, you know, and pray that we don't have a flashpoint, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, that's why I think it's just so critical right now for everybody who who cares about this country to, you know, however they can get off the bench and, you know, let our voices be heard, because it's real, you know, like it, the pace that they're, the amount of debt that's hanging over our kids' head. I mean, I think back in Davy Crockett's day, they probably could only put like one bill that did like one thing on the floor at a time. And nowadays you look at these freaking, like the COVID relief bill or the omnibus bills they put in that are like 500 pages. You're like, dude, no one knows what's in that.
Absolutely.
No one knew. Like, I think Massey made them read the last one on the floor, and it took them like 4 hours to read. And it's like, I'm glad Massey did that so everybody can see how ridiculous it is. But still, you know, no one, the guy that read it, he read it out loud. Nobody else did. Cause it's like, how much crap are they cramming in there? That's, you know, really just becomes a huge weight hanging over our kids and grandkids, you know, heads. It's insane.
Absolutely. And you want to know, I think that stuff's great. I actually like when Massey makes a mockery of stuff. I think that's awesome. Yeah. The one that no one really knows about unless they've participated in it is the farm bill. I've actually sat and helped in a room, like for a certain segment of people, help draft like what they wanted in the farm bill. And we were in there for like, you know, I can't remember, it was 4 or 6 hours. It was a long time. And the vast majority of the stuff that they were going over was not ag related at all, because most of these entitlement programs are run through USDA. So like all of the welfare and all of that, and I'm, you know, whatever, but all of the welfare stuff, all the food stamp stuff, every bit of that is in the farm bill every time. And I think most Americans have no idea that they do this, you know, cause then what they do is they add all this stuff that the right, you know, or the conservative right doesn't want into the package that has the stuff that the conservative right voters need. So it sort of pinches them in a way that they have to vote for. And it ends up being, you know, bipartisan, you know?
Yeah. I was pretty bummed to see last week that the GOP silently had a non-roll call vote to bring earmarks back.
Oh my,
you know,
Lord.
And it's only a handful of them that came out and said they didn't vote for it, like the Freedom Caucus and then Boebert and MTG and a couple of those ones said, I didn't vote for it. But then it was just like crickets from the rest of the GOP. And they're like, well, that passed. It's like, great. We just brought another mechanism for you guys to add paragraphs and pages of billions of dollars where you guys scratch each other's backs. You know, it's
absolutely unbelievable. And eventually it's not just the debt, because the debt is a big deal. But at this point, you know, the debt's like 28 trillion or something. You know, it's almost gotten to where that number is so impossible to comprehend that it's not even worth talking about, because no one cares. But the inflation that's going to come from this, I'm not an economist, but there's just no way, you can't print money like this and not end up with, you know, but let me give you a personal example. We just did a appraisal on our house because we're trying to refinance because rates are good right now.
Yeah.
And, our home gained $100,000 in value in 2 years, which is kind of like great for us, but it's in my opinion, seems like a really bad sign for the country. You know, like that doesn't seem like a natural, what it looks like to me is a real estate bubble. And so here we are in this, you know, in this very, like, I don't want to say hyperinflation, but where we could end up with hyperinflation, but we're in an inflationary period, and we might have a real estate bubble lurking underneath all of this. And then you add to that the Fed's lowering the interest rate. And then on top of all of that, you've been pushing off staying these mortgages since, you know, through the whole COVID thing. So you might end up with a whole bunch of defaults on a market that's already in a bubble scenario. Like this thing could be a time bomb, you know, and no one's talking about it. And, you know, I'm just some dumb horse trainer in Idaho. What the heck do I know? But it looks pretty bad to me. And, you know, I remember the last housing bubble and recession, and that really sucked, you know. I don't know, I'm really worried that we're doing that again. And I know that there's like not a whole heck of a lot you can do for that while you're in the middle of a primary, but I think voters, you know, maybe just educating voters on some of this stuff could be worthwhile, because like to your point earlier, if we were able to get, and I know it will never happen, but just, you know, put the pressure on people to sort of push a bill through that said, Kate, single issue bills only. That's it. You know, like if you could get that one thing done, that would change the country. You know,
you get like two pieces of paper max to explain your bill.
There you go.
And at the bottom, you put the price.
Yeah.
I'd say one page, but I guess, you know, if there's a lot of cosigners, so maybe we could be, you know, be generous and give them two pages. But yeah, no, I think you're right. Like, you don't have to be an economist to see what's going on, right? I mean, like, we locked down the economy and seriously crippled it. You know, if not, we definitely put some fatal wounds in there in the economy. There's industries that probably are straight up just not going to come back. Mm-hmm. And then we have continued borrowing. So we're not producing as much as we used to. We've killed off a lot of the economy. We're continuing to borrow, you know, we're continuing to borrow and inflate our own currency. I mean, that's like the recipe for the stagflation issues we had back before, I think, most of us were born, that really screwed over our economy in the 70s. And it took us a while to dig out of that. So like right now the conditions are even worse because we have more national debt. So there's less, you know, investors are less likely to buy our bonds. And then we're not producing as much as we used to. And then right now I don't see anything that Joe Biden and the Democrats are doing to stimulate the economy other than stimulus payments, which is just printing more money, which devalues the currency. So like, I don't feel like you need to have an economics degree at all just to see that we're in really bad shape, you know?
Absolutely.
But again, the Democrats just keep the hype machine going and they've got everybody hooked to these, and which I think, back to your Cernovich point, I do think it's intentional, man. I think that maybe they either want to, because the more drastic and bad things get, the more control the government can take. And COVID just showed them that, man, unfortunately, people are, you know, they're actually pretty easy to trick into submitting control to the government, way more so than I thought. This year's been insane with how quickly people will just say, oh, okay, well, if that's the recommendation, I'll do it.
Yeah, it terrified me. I completely agree. I mean, it was in a lot of ways the scariest thing. Like you say, is way worse than you thought. Same for me. It was. It honestly made me nervous because I never would have thought that my generation would, be this cowardly. And that is the right word, you know, because ultimately. With these lockdowns, if businesses, enough businesses, would have just flipped the middle finger, then the government can't do anything, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen a handful of businesses here in my district that had some good leadership, good entrepreneurs who were like, I'm done, man. Like I gave you guys the whatever 15 days to flatten the curve. And then I gave you another month or two. And so like around last summer, they said, screw it. And they opened back up and they're doing well. But I mean, I just thought it would have been so much more, man, especially like the restaurant and bar industry, which has pretty much been smoked by this whole COVID thing. Yeah. Every time I've been into a restaurant, the handful of times I've been in the last year, I'm just like, man, it's sad because you see that they're, you know, whatever, you're sitting people at every other table, the bars are empty, you know, like how many millions of dollars that these people were just, that they had taken from them. And I just can't believe there's not more of them that aren't absolutely defiant right now.
Well, this, I totally agree. And this brings me to a point that I bring up all the time. The West and the way, the traditional Western culture and Western spirit has been the one segment that I have seen that has bucked this thing from day one. Like, we were going to rodeos in, you know, the heat of all this COVID stuff, and they were just packed in there. No one's maybe like three people wearing masks or something. And I don't care if people wear a mask, but these people all just said, screw you, we're not doing that. And just went on and lived their thing, you know, lived their life. And if you look, it shows up like the rodeos who did what they were supposed to, or, you know, what I think they were supposed to do, and just went on, are doing fine this year. And the handful of ones that didn't, was a very, very small amount, you know, they're struggling. Same thing with sales and all this. So when I think of what we can do in the West, or in Congress with people like you, is just bring that sort of spirit and drive and all that, you know, because out here it's, you know, there's those libertarians have them, that anarcho cowboyism that they talk about. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting, funny thing that, you know, to me is a pipe dream. But anyway, I like the spirit of it, because that really is what, you know, how this country was made, particularly in the West. So we need like a bunch more of that. And Gail, the lady who, her and her husband started this network, she's big time into the rodeo scene and barrel horses and all this stuff. And she did this really cool thing, where she took, you know, fallen people, you know, KIA people, and she had their dog tags worn during the national finals rodeo during runs and stuff. Cool. Is like a, you know, a salute. And she, Shannon's was one of them that she did. And I had known, you know, we had talked before and I knew that Shannon rode horses a little bit, but I did not know, I guess I just did not realize to the extent to which that was a part of her life.
Yeah, it was a big part of her life, especially growing up. I mean, she grew up upstate New York, so there's a pretty big polo community of, I'd say, like, well-off folks that come out of the city to play polo. So she worked as a polo hand. That was kind of how she fell in love with horses, because basically they'd let her, I think they'd pay her a little bit to take care of the horses, but then she got to ride them mm-hmm. to kind of keep the horses fit. And so she, I think from middle school on, she worked out at a polo ranch and then even went down to Argentina. Because there was a lot of the really good, I guess, nationally or worldwide polo players come from Argentina. So she went down there. That's where she learned Spanish, worked on a polo ranch and just outside of Buenos Aires, and then continued. She had a horse on her at her house. Her parents lived on some land. They got her a horse eventually, and so her and her sister kind of grew up in stables, really, just raising horses.
That was really cool, and I, you know, because of who we are, it's just neat to make that connection, you know. So that spirit's got to be in there somewhere, you know.
It is, man. Yeah, first son's named Colt, so that was a name we agreed on. Like, I hadn't ridden a ton of horses, but I carried a Colt 45 a lot, kind of a fun thing. But I carried a Colt 45 a little bit in combat, so I was like, Colt's a badass name. She's like, yeah, so it's like it's a gun and it's a horse, and we were like, sold.
Absolutely, that is so neat, man. I didn't know that you packed one over there. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, fifth group had I think SF was on a 1911 craze for a little bit there, because there was the whole like, does the 1911 or the M9, does it have enough stopping power? That whole debate that was roaring hot in the 2000s. And so we got Wilson Combat 1911s, and then we had some Kimbers. So that was before SOCOM bought off on the Glocks. So there was like 2 or 3 years there where guys were tricking out their 1911s.
That's pretty dang cool, man. That's very cool. Well, we're going to have you back on. I actually talked to Dave about this before I even talked to you, but now I really got to talk to you again, because there's so much to hit on. Half of your state wants to become Idahoans.
I know, man. I know.
There's a lot to, so we got to, if you're up for it, we got to do this again.
Dude, definitely. Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. Thanks, bro. Tell everybody where to find you and how to support you.
Yeah, you can go to Joe Kent for Congress, the FOR Congress, .com. And then on there, there's a donate, obviously, and everybody's donations, because this is a war for resources, so I can get into DC and disrupt stuff. But I also have all the links to my social media on there. And then I have a tab that has all my stances on the various issues. And then there's a way you can email me directly on there. So appreciate it, man.
Okay, thanks, brother. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right, man. Take care.
See you. All right, that's it for the first episode. Go support Joe. The guy's absolutely awesome. I think he's going to do great things for our country. This is the first podcast we've done. We're going to try to get better at this as we go, and we're not going to focus on politics all the time. I just wanted to get Joe on here because we're like-minded. And so what I need you guys to do, here's what I need. I need some support. You guys have been awesome to me so far, and I hope you will continue to support the podcast like you have my other adventures. But what I need is I need at least 30 reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all these places where you get this podcast, because that's going to boost us in the algorithm. It'd be better if we could get 100, but rate and review this thing. I know everyone tells you to do that, but for us, especially as a startup show, it would be a huge, huge help. So the most important thing you could do for us is rate and review this thing and tell your friends about it, because podcasts still spread by word of mouth. The next episode, we're going to have my friend Brendan O'Reilly on, and we're going to talk about culture and manhood and what it's like growing up in Australia and fighting in the UFC and doing all kind of cool crap. So jump in on that one too, and I'll see y'all next time. Thank you.